Greetings, friends, and welcome to session number 7 of the Emotional Eating Breakthrough Program. I'm Mark David, founder of the Institute for the Psychology of Eating. The title of today's session is Nutrition and Lifestyle Influences on Emotional Eating. Now, this is an absolutely fascinating topic. I know you're going to benefit from this. And it's fascinating to me because even though emotional eating is indeed an emotional experience, it can often be triggered by or made worse from various nutritional and lifestyle factors that we're likely not aware of. That's the key. There are many influences of food and diet and other lifestyle habits that we don't see have a connection to emotional eating. But before we dive into new material, now that we're well over halfway through the program, let's do a brief recap so we can get up to date. I want to remind you that in session number 1, we created a foundation for understanding that each one of us, we're on a beautiful journey with food and body. We're here living out an epic story when it comes to eating, weight, health, and nutrition. And that's a wonderful thing. We looked at some of the landscape of nutritional science and eating psychology. We highlighted how a successful journey with emotional eating, with any kind of eating, requires that we let go of self-attack and self-judgment. You can't arrive at a destination of self-love and happiness if you're punishing yourself along the way. You also wrote your food and autobiography, food and body autobiography, as a way to get more intimate and generate more insight with your own story, to begin to fall in love with your own story, because it's a beautiful story. In session number 2, we examined the nature of emotional eating. We defined emotional eating in the most simplest of terms, the act of using food to regulate our emotions. We learned how emotional eating is not the problem per se, it's actually our solution, meaning you turn to food to feel better. There's always a brilliant reason rooted somewhere in biology and psychology or both as to why we would do any unwanted food behavior. We learned how the behavior of emotional eating is genetically built into our experience, how it begins in infancy, and how the mind always remembers, feel bad, eat food, feel better. We saw how emotional eating is not an indication that something's wrong with you or that you're inherently broken. It's simply a strategy that starts in infancy and that we naturally bring into adulthood because it works. We talked about how practice is the key to transforming any unwanted habit, meaning consistent work on self using effective tools and strategies. You did the what else inventory, where you explored behaviors that you can do other than turning to food to regulate your unwanted emotions. This what else practice is a key to transforming emotional eating. Now in session number 3, we explored the science and psychology of emotional eating. Remember, we looked at the inborn human need for instant gratification and how this desire for instant reward, when left unchecked, can drive our unwanted emotional eating. We looked at how to graduate from being driven by instant gratification, and that's by learning to notice the younger and more immature voice in us that can drive us to say, I want what I want when I want it. We did a deep dive into understanding the physiologic stress response, and we detailed the unwanted impact of stress, real or imagined, including self-chosen stress, on our emotional eating, the impact it has on our digestion, our calorie burning, our natural appetite regulation. We introduced the practice of slow, relaxed, pleasured, aware, nourished eating in whenever you eat, and especially when you emotionally eat. Yet another powerful key to transforming emotional eating. In session number 4, we talked about reframing or redefining emotional eating. We introduced a whole new understanding of emotional eating that's a powerful game changer, specifically that it's a great teacher. Emotional eating is not an indication that you're broken or defective. On the contrary, it's here to help you grow. It's calling you into becoming your best self. We looked at quite a few possible lessons that emotional eating may be trying to teach you. As we learn the important key life lessons that emotional eating is teaching us, trying to whisper in our ear. This enables us to finally graduate from the need to emotionally eat. Some of those lessons that emotional eating is trying to teach us can include, not limited to, patience and forgiveness, awareness, self-expression, slowing down, letting go of self-attack, finding your voice, feeling your feelings, being more real and authentic, embracing your sensuality, your sexuality, embracing pleasure, addressing challenges in our relationships, finding meaning, purpose, spirituality, much more. In session 5, we looked at toxic dietary beliefs and how these old, outdated, and never quite work for us beliefs can drive our unwanted emotional eating, while at the same time they generate a fight or flight response, i.e. the stress response, with all its unwanted impact on our health. The beliefs, by the way, were food is my enemy, appetite is my enemy. If only I was thin or had the perfect body or the perfect shape or the perfect weight, then I'd be happy. And the last toxic dietary belief we looked at is I must be perfect. In the last session, session number 6, we looked at the various life stages through the lens of the royal archetypes, and we explored powerful distinctions for the princess, queen, prince, and king stages. Now, for today, let's jump into this week's, what I think is some juicy information about nutritional and lifestyle influences on emotional eating. So, by definition, emotional eating is the unwanted behavior of using food to regulate our emotions. It's an emotionally driven experience. With that said, though, many of us have certain dietary strategies. We have nutritional habits. We have certain dietary excesses or deficiencies, which can trigger emotional eating and or make it worse. So this dietary and nutritional connection can be very strong and can often stand directly in the way of healing our emotional eating. So that's what today's conversation is all about. That's why this is so important. Let me state this in another way. Many people struggle so much with emotional eating that we can feel like we're constantly fighting a losing battle. But the problem often is, not always, but often is, yes, I have an emotional eating challenge, but my diet is driving it to be worse. So no matter how much good work we do on self, on an inner level, if we don't notice the ways that diet and nutrition might be locking in our emotional eating, you're not going to find the success you deserve. The good news is, though, stated in the positive, once you see how your approach to eating and your nutrition can be driving your emotional eating, you're going to make headway like never before. So, let's look at the main nutrition and lifestyle factors that impact emotional eating. I'm going to just go through a list and detail them out. First on the list, and probably first for a good reason, because I tend to see it so often. First on the list is the impact of chronic dieting on emotional eating. Chronic dieting, or endless dieting, or constant dieting, or lifelong dieting. I'm using those terms interchangeably. So chronic dieting means living a lifestyle where we are consistently underfeeding ourselves in the interest of losing weight or not gaining it. So essentially, we're not taking in enough calories. The body is operating on an energy deficit. If you're endlessly dieting, emotional eating will be predictable. I see this constantly. Why is that true? Because we are indeed nutritionally deprived if you are not eating enough food. We're lacking in macronutrition. Chances are either protein, fat, or carbohydrate, or fiber. We might be lacking in micronutrition, vitamins and minerals. And again, we're lacking in basic caloric value from food, meaning enough fuel from the food for energy. Now, when this happens, as always, the brain is not smart enough to tell us that, hey, dieting isn't working for you. Dieting is making you nutritionally deficient. Brain doesn't say that. The brain simply notices, it scans the body, it notices a nutrient deficit, and it screams hungry. And so we are physiologically driven to eat more. We are neurologically driven to eat more. The body is demanding that you eat more because it thinks it's starving. And then what happens? You eat, and then what happens? You think you have a willpower problem. Willpower weakling, I have no control, what's my issue? Which leads to self-attack, which leads to self-rejection, guilt, shame, self-hate, the whole cascade of unwanted thinking and self-conversation. So here's the thing. If you've been dieting for a long time, then that's proof positive, number one, that dieting doesn't work. Too many people are driven to emotionally eat, not because they have a willpower problem, but because they have a nutritional deficiency that's fueled by constant dieting and calorie restriction. So paradoxically, the thing you're trying to do, calorie restrict, not eat food, will drive you at some point to eat, emotionally eat. Now, we're going to have a nice long conversation about emotional eating and weight in our next session. But the bottom line here is that if you've been dieting for decades, you are locking in unwanted emotional eating. This is one of the most potent and profound influences on emotional eating. Because so many people mistake calorically deficient driven hunger, i.e. starvation response driven hunger, for emotional eating. So when you're nutritionally deprived and calorically deprived and the brain drives you to eat, in the moment, it feels very emotional. And you likely are being emotional because you feel you failed. You're giving into your appetite. You're giving into your hunger, which then means you're self-rejecting. And your physiologically driven hunger is doing the double service of, on the good hand, giving your starving body much needed nutrition, but on the other hand, it's also giving you emotional regulation and relief. So there's just a whole bunch of paradox and confusion happening in the mind, because when you're driven to eat because of lack of nutrition in the diet, on one level, your body's happy. On another level, you're happy because you kind of feel better eating food. And on another level, you're the opposite of happy because you've given in. And you've proven to yourself now that you're a willpower weakling. But no, you've just proven that you're not quite thinking accurately from a psychological and scientific standpoint. If you are deficient in food, if you're deficient in calories, if you're deficient in nutrient, your brain will take notice and it'll drive you to eat. And you will mistake that for a weakness. You will call that emotional eating. You'll self-diagnose as emotional eating. And you feel emotional because I have failed at my task to resist food and to learn how to not eat. And you think you're no good. So yeah, you're an emotional experience. So you call it emotional eating. But it's actually driven by a dietary practice that does not work for you. So, closely related to chronic dieting, many people find themselves meal skipping, meaning you might choose to skip breakfast, you might choose to skip lunch, you might choose to skip both. Now, people have different reasons or excuses for skipping meals. Some people say, well, I'm just busy, too busy, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And, you know, that might very, very well be true for some people. And I would like to say meal skipping is often a form of what we can call stealth dieting. Meaning, you really want to be dieting. You kind of are dieting, but you're kind of not, but you kind of are, but you're kind of not. So if you skip a meal, hey, that's sort of like dieting. Good girl, good boy, because you're not eating calories, and therefore, you're going to potentially lose weight. You certainly won't gain it. Now, whether you skip meals because your schedule's busy, parenting, work, because you forget, or because you're stealth dieting, the result is the same. Emotional eating is predictable. Once again, the brain will wisely sense a lack of nutrition. Micro and macronutrition is going to sense a lack of caloric fuel. And then it screams hungry. And then you're physiologically driven to eat. And then you conclude, I'm emotionally eating, but the real problem is, you need to eat in a rhythmic, regular way. You need to create a balanced rhythm. the body is a rhythmic creature. It's a rhythmic entity. You eat food, you digest it, you assimilate nutrients, you burn calories, you excrete what you don't need, and then you rinse and you repeat. That's a rhythm. All of your biology, all of it is based on rhythm. Your heart rate is a rhythm. Your brainwave patterns are a rhythm. Your breathing is a rhythm. Your waking and sleeping is a rhythm. If you interfered with the rhythm of your heart rate, you would die. If you interfered with the rhythm of your breathing in the correct or the wrong way, you can die. If your brainwaves flatten, you die. You're dead. So you can't deny the body its rhythmic nature. We are a biocircadian creature. And it just so happens that the process of nutrition, the process of nutritional metabolism, it follows a rhythmic pattern. So if you're the kind of person who skips meals and you're challenged with emotional eating, the remedy is simple. No meal skipping. I'm not saying nobody should skip meals. I'm just saying if you have a challenge called emotional eating, then if you're a meal skipper, heads up. Let's pay attention. And if you're a meal skipper, I'm going to say practice not skipping meals. Don't forget, don't sacrifice your nutritional health for your work or your kids. I want you to experiment with eating 3 times a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You can also include 2 snack times in between if you need them. And then you notice what happens with your emotional eating. You are being a nutritional experimenter. You're being a nutritional explorer. That's how you determine what works and what doesn't. You take the power and you use what's logical and you experiment and you see what works and what doesn't. I want you to think of it this way. Dieting and meal skipping trains you unsuccessfully how not to eat. That's what you're trying to do when you're dieting. That's what you're kind of doing when you're meal skipping. You're training yourself to not eat. Your task moving forward in life is to learn how to eat, how to become an eater. Reminder, becoming an eater, what does that mean? How to eat, what does that mean? That in part means you make food your best friend. It's no longer your enemy. You welcome your appetite. It's no longer your enemy. You see your relationship with food as a great teacher. You're not fighting all your problems and thinking you're broken. You take away the intense moral value from food. Yeah, certain foods are good for my health, certain foods detract from my health, but the food itself is not morally good or morally bad, meaning if you eat a food that's on your bad list, that doesn't make you a bad person. Nor if you eat a food on your good list, it doesn't make you some good, saintly, holy person. Food itself is neutral. We're the ones who give it value. So it's all about making sure that we don't go into moralism in our own life and say, oh, I'm a bad person because I did this. Because then you're constantly in self-punishment. So how do you learn how to become an eater? You stop bullying yourself. You stop bullying your body with unkind and stress-provoking words and thoughts that are ruining your nutritional and calorie-burning metabolism. You learn to eat slow, but eating slow means being present. It means being aware. You learn to receive pleasure from food. Receiving pleasure from food is proof positive that you're not fighting it. You're not looking at food as a pain. Receiving pleasure from food catalyzes the relaxation response. Eating slow catalyzes a relaxation response. That's your optimum state of digestion and assimilation, natural appetite regulation, and your most natural day-in, day-out calorie-burning capacity. You're eating quality food. You're learning how to, yeah, you can have foods that are bad for you. You don't have to eat everything perfect. But by and large, you see if you can eat 70, 80, 90% of your diet, make it higher quality. Forgive yourself whenever you go against your own wishes and eat something that you wanted to avoid. These are some of the key ways that you learn how to eat. Okay. Here's another hidden cause or instigator of emotional eating, and that's macronutrient imbalance. So the macronutrients I'm focusing on here are protein, fat, and carbohydrates. Technically, we can consider water and fiber as macronutrients. So in other words, many people are eating a diet that's either low in protein, or it's low in fat, or it's low in carbohydrates, or it's a combination of these. So many of the popular diets are variations on a theme when it comes to manipulating or changing macronutrient balance. You have high protein diets, low protein diets, high carb diets, low carb diets, high fat, low fat, and everything in between. Now, diets that emphasize certain macronutrient ratios or approximate ones, like a high protein diet, for example, can definitely have a good nutritional function. Just about any diet you've probably heard of can be useful. But when overdone, these diets can lead to deficiencies and cravings. Many diets that you follow can work for a time. They're time stamped. They have a limited time value, meaning they work well for a certain period because they give you a therapeutic value, but they're not so good as a long-term maintenance diet. And people think, oh my God, well, I've been on this, you know, whatever the diet is, a low-carb diet, and I feel great and I lost weight, but all of a sudden I'm craving all these carbs, and all of a sudden I'm stuffing my face and I can't stop eating, but I have to stay on this diet for the rest of my life because of all the great science I read and I've had this one good experience on it. Therefore, I should be on it all my life. I don't know about that. Says who? We know it can have a good short-term effect on you. Maybe we modify the diet. Okay, example. Fat, let's say fat is essential to human life. That's why we call them essential fats, essential fatty acids, EFAs. If you're eating too low in fat, the brain's going to eventually scream hungry. That's his job. Fat comprises much of the cell walls in your body. It comprises much of your brain. Suck all the fat out of your body, you'd be dead in an instant. If you're eating too low in protein, same is going to happen. The body's going to call for food. Many people are following a low-carb diet. Again, this can have benefits, but if you're going too low in carbs, cravings are predictable. Now, such cravings, let's say carbs, for example, it can be quite intense. The body might be hungering for fiber. It might be hungering for easy energy. It might just be hungering for the pleasure of something sweet. And when intense cravings occur for people, because they're following whatever scientifically proven diet or a diet promoted by an expert, and it's low in a particular macronutrient, and we find ourselves craving and eating a bunch of foods, once again, we think we have a willpower problem. We think we have an emotional eating problem. And from there, we could easily self-reject, self-attack, make up all this bad words about who we are and what we're about, when the real issue is the body is simply calling for more of the thing that we were deficient in. And it's screaming. And you're trying to follow your perfect diet perfectly, and then when you finally can't follow your perfect diet perfectly, because the brain is rebelling, because it wants something it's determining your body is low in, or it's determining, okay, maybe this isn't a good long-term diet for this body. You feel bad about yourself. You feel like you failed. So in that moment, it feels like emotional eating. Extreme diets will often, not always, often lead to extreme cravings. It's predictable. I wish I could go to Las Vegas and bet money on that. If you don't eat in a way that's sustainable for you, cravings are predictable. So you have to be your own best nutritionist. You don't have to be an expert in nutrition. You just have to observe yourself. Don't be hypnotized by every new diet that hits the market. Think, okay, this is the one true road to success. Don't be dazzled by people who are using big words and letting you know that this is the perfect way to eat. If somebody's saying this is the perfect way to eat, you immediately want to have your yellow caution light go on. Frankly, I don't see it. I've traveled around the world a little bit. Human beings are different. Genetics are different. Climate is different. Atmosphere is different. Age is different. Culture is different. It's all different. So what works for one person doesn't necessarily work for another. So the remedy is really simple. You got to strike a balance with what you eat. That's it. If you don't think that you can go extremely low in a particular macronutrient, protein, fat, or carbohydrate for a long time, unless you have some very specific medical condition that's requiring this. So this is true for a lot of people of fat when it comes to fat and carbohydrates also these days, interestingly enough. But for the longest time, people have had this toxic dietary belief that fat in food equals fat on my body, which it does not. Yeah, poor quality fat, poor quality of fats differ. So poor quality fats can lead to weight gain or weight loss resistance. So just make sure when it comes to fat, you're choosing high quality fats, avocados, olive oil, coconut, nuts and seeds, nut and seed butters, high quality fish, high quality meat, high quality dairy products. My friends, when it comes to macronutrients, don't worry about exact amounts. A lot of times I hear people say, well I need to know exactly how many protein, fat, and carbohydrates. I'm like, no, you don't. You made that up. There is zero, and I mean zero science to what exact amount of macronutrient any specific human being needs. Or exact amount of any vitamin or mineral, exact amount that any human being needs. So just, you got to get over that. Recommendations from scientific or government bodies are always based on ranges and guesstimates. That's all it is. You're learning to listen and tune into your own body. You're learning to be a nutritional experimenter. You're learning to be a nutritional explorer. You're learning to trust yourself more. You're learning to take the information that you're learning and test it and see what works for me, what doesn't. That's all. Okay, let's take a look at another nutritional influence on emotional eating. Specifically, it's eating a carbohydrate-only breakfast. Eating a carbohydrate-only breakfast and how that affects emotional eating. So, this is an interesting one. Now, when I say a carbohydrate-only breakfast, this means that at breakfast, your first meal of the day, you're only eating some form of carbohydrates. For example, you're eating only, for the most part, a sugary breakfast cereal with some milk, let's say. Or you're just eating a muffin, or you're just eating a croissant, or you're just eating a pastry, or some bread and jam, or a donut, or just oatmeal, or mostly bread, or a breakfast bar that's mostly carbs, or just a bunch of juice. I think you're getting the picture here. So it's actually very surprising to me. There's been some fascinating, well-documented, and well-repeated research. It's interesting that this has been very much repeated, which shows that when people eat a carbohydrate-only breakfast, let's say oatmeal and orange juice, for example, here's the thing, they'll tend to crave carbohydrates and sugar throughout the day. This is compared to those who, say, eat eggs at breakfast or a full-fat yogurt or a protein-centered shake at breakfast. So many people, not every single one, many people who eat a carbohydrate-only breakfast will tend to crave carbs and sugar throughout the day. Why is this important? Because once again, let's say you're eating breakfast cereal every day, sugary breakfast cereal. Or you're eating a donut every day at breakfast, donut and coffee, and you find yourself craving sugar throughout the day, and therefore you have a sugar problem and a carb issue, and you think your problem is not enough willpower, but we're simply creating a craving unknowingly by our style of eating, by our habitual way of eating. So if you struggle with emotional eating, and you particularly crave sweets and other carbs during the day, and you eat a relatively carbohydrate-only breakfast, then start experimenting, there's that word again, experiment with a breakfast centered on healthy protein and or healthy fat. This can mean a breakfast, examples, that features a full-fat yogurt. You can do dairy yogurt. You could do non-dairy yogurt. A full-fat cheese or cottage cheese, a healthy smoothie with protein powder, dairy protein powder, vegan protein powder. Throw in some nut butter, throw in some high quality coconut oil. It can mean a breakfast meal that's centered on high quality breakfast meats or high-quality breakfast fish, high-quality dairy products. You can still have your toast or jam or juice or muffin. Just make sure the meal is centered around a healthy protein or fat. The results can be very noticeable and very quick in terms of decreased sweet and carb cravings throughout the rest of your day. So it's a very worthy experiment. Now, I want to remind you of something here. There's no right or wrongs here. Plenty of people do fine on a carbohydrate-only breakfast. There's lots of people do fine on a carbohydrate-only breakfast. I am not saying everyone should eat a carb, nobody should eat a carbohydrate-only breakfast. I'm not saying that. Any nutritional recommendation that I'm telling you, I'm not saying everyone should eat this way. I really want you to get that straight. This conversation is about addressing a specific complaint, emotional eating, by looking at all the potential, perhaps nutritional influences that might be triggering that emotional eating, and then making nutritional tweaks and experiments that give us the best probability of getting a positive result. So it's not about do's and don'ts, good or bad, right or wrong. It's about, once again, you being a willing nutritional explorer when it comes to working with emotional eating. So again, if you emotionally eat and you tend to eat a carbohydrate-only breakfast, then this is a great experiment for you. If you don't emotionally eat and you always eat a carbohydrate-only breakfast, good for you. It works for you. Here's another hidden nutritional influence on emotional eating. And that's what I'm going to simply call a poor quality diet. This is a fascinating conversation to have because, you know, many people can find themselves eating quite a lot of food and yet they still remain hungry. I've been seeing this since I started doing nutritional counseling in my late teens. Now, people eat a lot of food and they're still hungry. And one of the reasons is that this is often driven by, not always, but it's often driven by or contributed to by eating what I'm going to call a poor quality diet. A poor quality diet can mean a diet that's centered largely on just the classic junk foods, sodas, poor quality chips, poor quality oils, hydrogenated oils, store-bought luncheon meats, poor quality breads, poor quality cereals, energy drinks that don't have much nutrition in it, foods with poor nutrient density. Far too many food products can be purchased for cheap because they don't have much nutritional value, meaning these foods are literally less nutrient dense, pound for pound. They have less vitamins, minerals, and associated cofactors. Such foods are mass-produced commodity items. In other words, they're manufactured to make the biggest profit. Such foods are not made to help people be healthier human beings. I'm sorry. That's just the way of the world. I wish it was different. Most of the large food companies do not practice a kind and caring way of making sure that you're getting the healthiest food. So the bottom line here is that when we eat low quality, low nutrition food, our appetite regulation is skewed. So even if you eat a large amount of poor quality ice cream, a large amount of poor quality carbohydrates and breads and pastas and sugary foods, the gut, brain, and head brain are always going to scan the body, sense a lack of nutrition from our poor quality diet, and the result is that the brain screams hungry, even though you ate a lot of food. Eating quality could be a dilemma for a lot of people. It can tend to be more expensive. Plus, we're often attached to foods that we grew up with or that our family eats, that the people around us eat, and those foods might not be the best choices for our health. It takes a strong commitment to one's emotional and physical health to go from a poorer quality diet to a higher quality one. Also, so many of the foods that we buy, typical supermarket foods, are literally created and chemically engineered to suck us into attachment. They hook us. They drive us through well-researched combinations of fat, sugar, salt, crunch level, textures, synthetic flavors. They drive us to feel hungry, even after we've eaten a lot of that food. They drive us to want more of it. The result is we think that we lack willpower, that we don't have control, The result is we think there's something wrong with us, but essentially, you're just a mere human who's been duped by the food companies to get hooked on their products. I'm sorry to say that. You are literally being manipulated by food scientists, sorry guys, who know how to addict your brain. So the remedy here is to be nutritionally defiant. Claim your naturalness. Reclaim your brain and your senses. This means you eat real, you eat fresh, you eat organic, you eat natural, you try to eat local, you try to eat grass-fed, and you mainly produce meats if you eat meat. You go for non-GMO foods. You go for wild-caught fish. You try to eat high-quality, real and or raw dairy products. You try to go for organically produced vegetables, fruits, grains, etc., and a diet without poor quality fats, without hydrogenated oils, without high fructose corn sweetener, without artificial flavors or sweeteners, other unnatural ingredients. Now, you can educate yourself there. Chances are you already have. But if you haven't, it's worth it. If you want to learn to better manage your emotional eating, if you want to learn to better manage your weight, switching to high quality by itself can make a huge difference. Eating higher quality food means more nutrient-dense food, more nutrition per ounce, per pound, compared to poor quality versions of that food. If you find yourself emotionally, high quality food is the real health insurance. So again, if you find yourself emotionally eating and you eat a high junk food, poor quality diet, then you know what to do. Experiment with a better diet. Do your best. Think of the 80-20 rule. See if you can go 80% good quality. You don't have to try to be perfect. Enroll friends and loved ones around you to experiment with you as well, to generate support. That's always a great one. Enlisting other people in the new healthy habits that you're doing. Here's another hidden driver of emotional eating that always surprises me. And it's people who follow a low pleasure diet. Pleasure, we require it. Vitamin P. We are designed to seek pleasure and avoid pain. Now, a lot of people believe that if I eat anything that's pleasurable, I'm going to never want to stop and I'm going to keep gaining weight. Sometimes that's a little true because a lot of the foods that we're eating have been designed by the food scientists to hook your brain. So there is a certain reality to that. And what ends up happening for a lot of people is we try to avoid all sugar, all desserts, any fun foods. Sounds like a reasonable strategy. Sounds like it makes sense. But here's the thing. When we avoid pleasure completely from food, when we're trying to banish pleasure from the plate, and you end up eating a diet that occurs to you as lifeless and bland, the brain is going to eventually scream hungry. As humans, we require pleasure. We are hardwired to seek pleasure and avoid pain. When we don't get pleasure, the body lets us know. And so we find ourselves at some point binge eating or emotionally eating because there's this thing we're lacking. We're lacking an experience. Animals tend to feed. Humans tend to eat. We're looking for something more. We're looking for cuisine. We're looking for an experience. Animals aren't sitting around discussing the merits of different kind of grass and trying to find sauces to put on their grass and saute it or find new grass recipes. Cows don't do that. Humans do that. So there's a value that we have for pleasure. There's a need that we have for pleasure. And when we deny the body pleasure, the body lets us know. Now, this is especially the case if you're following a weight loss diet that is extreme and that has no pleasure or enjoyment in it. The body is not going to be denied. You're built for pleasure. And chances are, if you're trying to completely deny yourself pleasure from food, you're likely withholding pleasure from other areas of life. It spills over. So if you're the kind of person who thinks you need to fight pleasure, you have the toxic belief, pleasure is my enemy, you got to let that one go. Yeah, there might be certain foods that trigger you. Great. Let's find other pleasurable foods then. Let's avoid those trigger foods. Let's find other pleasurable foods for me that I can enjoy and experience pleasure from. And remember, in order to experience pleasure, you have to be present. You have to be aware. You can't be checked out. You got to be checked in. A checked out person, someone who's asleep at the plate and you're eating, how are you going to feel pleasure? You can't. But a part of you is trying to feel pleasure, but your brain's not registering pleasure. So if you're checked out and you're eating fast and you're not receiving pleasure, your brain says, I'm eating a bunch of food, but I'm not receiving any pleasure. Something's not right here. Hungry. Your brain's not smart enough to tell you, hey, slow down, relax, be nourished, take it easy, put your feet up, get some pleasure. Brain can't tell us that. So see if you can include some of the pleasures in your diet. Might even be a guilty pleasure, whatever food that means for you. Plan on having pleasure in your diet. Build in a dessert that you know you're going to eat. Take time to enjoy it. Be there. Get the pleasure that your brain and soul and mind and emotions are seeking from that food. If you're going to eat something that you consider pleasurable, even if it's on your bad list, and you're going to eat it, it is your job to get present, slow down, be there, and eat it. Remember again, we talked about the practice that when you emotionally eat, your task is to do it slowly and suck out all the experience that you can from it. Make it worth your while. Why are you emotionally eating? Because you're trying to get rid of pain, you're seeking pleasure, you're avoiding pain. Great, then do it. Because then you stay awake, then you stay present, you're practicing your choosing muscle. You're going to more naturally regulate your appetite. You're not going to need to eat as much of that food. You're training yourself how to be an eater. It's not always going to be perfect. Yeah, sometimes you might end up eating too much. Okay, great. You practice. Don't be so fragile about yourself. You got to trust yourself. You got to trust your life. You have to trust your body. You have to trust your journey with food. You can learn to be an eater. Why? Because it's built into your system. If you have any type of eating challenge, it's because you live in a world that has conditioned you to have that eating challenge. Ain't that? It's not your fault. You didn't invent it. You didn't invent emotional eating. You live in a world that supports emotional eating. You live in a world that triggers emotional eating. It's a crazy world. So build in pleasure into your diet. Be responsible, of course, you know, but notice where you need to loosen up and let pleasure into your food life and into any other part of your life. Because if you deny yourself pleasure, you're going to rubber band back. And then when you rubber band back, you're going to go, oh my God, I'm a willpower weakling. I'm emotionally eating. No, what you're really doing is you're having a moment where you're in reaction to the fact that you've been denying your body and your soul something that's essential to human life. And you're calling it emotional eating. Now, let's look at a fascinating aspect of emotional eating that a lot of people tend to miss. And that's following a diet or a nutritional approach that doesn't work for you. A lot of people are following various diets, weight loss diets, or nutritional approaches that at some point doesn't work for them. This could mean you're following a vegan diet or a vegetarian diet or a paleo diet or a raw food diet or a keto diet, just as an example. I'm not saying any of these are bad. All I'm saying is sometimes you could follow a diet and that particular diet does not work for you. Or it worked for a time and then it stopped working. There's all other kinds of diets out there. Now, if you choose a nutritional approach that you're trying to follow perfectly, then emotional eating just might be right around the corner. Here's the thing. Many of us are wonderful nutritional explorers. I like that about this day and age. A lot of people are trying all kinds of different nutritional approaches. We're open to trying new diets for health, longevity, energy, weight loss. But the challenge is, even though we can notice some great benefits from these diets, they're not always easy to follow. They're just not. And they're not always easy to follow 100% perfectly all the time. So if you're a perfectionist, or if you believe Or if the expert has said to you, you're involved, this diet perfectly all the time, otherwise bad, bad you, bad person, you're eating a bad food, you should punish yourself, you're not going to get results, you're going to be in bad person, bad food, prison, jail. If that's what you're telling yourself, then you're on this particular specific diet and then you start to have cravings. You're on a vegan or vegetarian diet, you might crave meat. You're on a paleo diet and you might get sick of it. You're on a raw food diet, you might crave something cooked. You're on a keto diet and you might crave something that's completely off that diet. And all sugary and whatever it is. So you get a craving and then you think you're emotionally eating. You think you're a failure. You think you're a willpower weakling. You find yourself binging on something that's not in that diet, or you're not even binging on, you're not even eating it, you're just craving it. And then you're fighting yourself. And you're thinking there's something wrong with you because you're fighting yourself. Now, I want you to know having such cravings does not mean that there's something wrong with you. If you're on a high protein diet, if you're on a low carb diet and you're craving carbs, it doesn't mean that you lack mental fortitude or willpower. But that's a conclusion that a lot of people come to. So we label our cravings or our eating of the bad food, so to speak, as emotional eating. But it's often just a reaction to a diet that's too difficult for you to follow. Perhaps you just can't do it. And there's nothing wrong with you. It's just a difficult to follow diet. Some of these diets were easy to follow, they'd be easy to follow. Or perhaps the diet, again, just works for a short, limited period of time. Just because a nutritional approach works short term doesn't mean it's good and healthy long term. So you got to listen to your body, got to pay attention, you got to tune in. Whenever our eating feels driven and beyond our control, it's easy to label it as an emotional weakness and hence emotional eating. When you believe that you're emotional eating, it's easy to go into the dark and unhappy place. So you got to stop judging yourself when these experiences happen. Be curious. We're imperfect human beings. You're not machines that can be programmed to eat in a very specific way and never, ever, ever veer from eating the chosen diet in a perfect, infallible, and military way. This is not how we're built. So the idea is if you're following a particular nutritional approach, you do the best you can. If you believe you have to do it 100% perfectly, then you might be setting yourself up for failure. And then you might call that failure emotional eating. And then you end up in an unfortunate cycle. I think the key is you got to forgive yourself for not being perfect and create more reasonable expectations of yourself. And instead of saying, I've broken the rules, therefore I'm bad, therefore I'm a criminal, therefore I need to punish myself because the rules of the keto diet says eat this, 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 and this, but don't eat that, 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 and you ate that, therefore I'm bad, I'm evil, I'm a criminal, I need to be punished. So instead of doing that, just change the rules, change the laws. Yeah, you can have a dessert here and there. And if somebody tells you, no, that's unreasonable, then you have to make a choice. You have to make a choice around your own happiness and your own ability to follow a particular kind of diet. And ultimately, you have to make choices that empower you. Ultimately, you have to make choices that at the end of the day uplift you. Because if your choices are not uplifting and empowering, then you're not going to feel good about yourself. And if you don't feel good about yourself, you're going to want to medicate those not good feelings. And you're going to reach for your favorite medicine, which is, for many of us, food. Emotional eating. Okay, let's take a look at a very juicy topic. And it's the conundrum. I love that word. The conundrum of sugar and emotional eating. Woo, what a big one. Now, for those who are challenged with emotional eating, sugar can feel like kryptonite. Now, when talking about sugar, it's helpful to remember that we human beings essentially have five kinds of taste buds on the tongue. We have sweet, salty, sour, bitter, and savory. Some people call savory umami. That's a fun word too. So sweet, salty, sour, bitter, and savory. And we have quite a good amount of sweet taste buds, interestingly enough. Many of them, majority of them, are centered in the middle and towards the front of the tongue, which is where most of your food tends to hit and land. So you actually are designed biologically, for the wisdom of the universe, you are designed with sweet taste buds on your tongue, centered on the sweet spot where most of the food tends to hit. So what on earth do you think those sweet taste buds are doing on your tongue? What do you think they're doing there? They're sitting there. They're tapping their foot and they're waiting for something sweet. That's what they're doing. The wisdom of life did not give you sweet taste buds to torture you. The wisdom of life did not give you salty taste buds so you'd have your blood pressure artificially raised. The wisdom of life gives you taste buds because they're there to provide sensation. They are there to provide pleasure. Particularly with sweet taste buds, when you eat something sweet, you know deep inside that it can't kill you. Nature has taught us over eons of time that there are no poisonous sweet foods in nature. You got some bland poisonous foods. You got pungent poisonous foods. You got sour poisonous foods. You're not going to find any poisonous sweet foods in nature. So sweet is sort of the success when you find it in your environment. You know you can eat it. So we have a bit of a predisposition to sweet. To an infant, sweet occurs more powerfully in terms of mother's milk. So if an adult tasted mother's milk, it would not taste as sweet to their taste buds as it tastes to an infant. To an infant, mother's milk is pretty sweet. So sweetness, and in particular sugar, poses a fascinating challenge for a lot of human beings. I just want to lay the turf here for a minute and just look at what we're dealing with. When the brain senses sugar, okay, you're eating and the brain goes, ooh, there's some sugar here. The moment the brain senses sugar, it automatically tends to want more. Now, you could retrain your brain otherwise, but for majority of humans, this happens with kids all the time, as soon as their brain senses sugar, it wants more. That's because when sweet foods, i.e. fruits, are available in nature, in our environment, in non-tropical climates, that means that winter is around the corner. Hang in there with me. In non-tropical environments, fruits come out in the summer and fall. Bears, for example, will get ultra fat on blueberries. They will clean up entire mountainsides of blueberries. They get fat. They get a lot of bear fat. And they will use their bear body fat as a nutritional and caloric source as they hibernate. So when the brain senses sweet, it literally gets excited, it feels pleasure, and it drives us to eat more so we as mammals can successfully hibernate. Your brain thinks, oh, it's sugar. Must be summer. Must be early fall. Winter, ooh, is around the corner. So let me load up on sugar right now while it's available so I can get nice and plump so I can hibernate and have all the caloric source that I need. So sugar functions in what's called a feed-forward loop in the brain. You sense sugar, you're physiologically driven to want more as a means to survive. Now, here's the problem. We don't live in a quote-unquote natural environment anymore, so to speak. Sweet sugary foods are available not just in the summer and the fall. They're available 24/7, year-round, anytime, anywhere. You can just probably walk a block from where you live and get all kinds of sugary foods. What's more, when it comes to emotional eating, sugar does the trick as good as any substance, if not better. Sugar can yield as potent a pleasure chemistry release as any substance. Actually, some of the biggest pleasure chemistry releases with a food happens when you combine a 50-50 ratio of fat and sugar. But sugar lets the brain know we are having a good time. So if you're the kind of person who experiences sugar as a trigger food, first and foremost, you're not a willpower weakling. Essentially, you're wired that way for survival. So step one, Stop judging yourself. Stop punishing yourself. It's unnecessary. It might be problematic for you. I get it. But there's a difference between something being problematic and judging the heck out of yourself because you do it. So just keep remembering this. If you feel any amount of helplessness around sweet foods, there's a biologically driven reason behind it. You're not broken. Your brain is doing its job and it's trying to drive you to eat something that it thinks will be helping you survive a long, cold winter. So here's some tried and true practices for helping anyone who struggles with sugar cravings, and i.e. you're struggling with I emotionally eat and I emotionally eat the sweet stuff. First, as I mentioned, if you want to have more power over your sugar cravings, stop attacking yourself, stop judging, stop health hate, stop the self-hate. Because all of these create a stress response. And when you're in stress, number one, your appetite is deregulated. You will tend to want to eat more. A lot of people, about 85% of people I've noticed, this is an unofficial statistic, it's just me polling people over the years, about 85% of people when they're under stress eat more, about 15% eat less. And there's a number that seems to change that some people will do one or both, one or the other. So bottom line is, when you're under stress, you're going to be driven to eat more. So if sugar cravings are stressing you out and you're stressing yourself out because you do it, I'm no good, I'm a willpower weakling, I'm broken, you're going to be creating more stress. It's going to trigger you to want more sugar. It's going to trigger you to want to deal with your emotions of self-attack and self-blame and self-upset. Okay, second, if you eat something sweet, if you're going to eat something sweet, you gotta be present. You got to eat it slowly and sensuously and extract as much pleasure as you can from that sweet experience. You have to get what you want. You have to learn how to relax when you do this thing that you said you didn't want to do. Because this happens every day to millions of people around the globe. I have a food rule. Don't eat that, whatever that is. And then you end up eating that. So all I'm saying is when you eat the sugar, because you're going to anyway, deep breath, slow down, relax, get present, suck all the pleasure out of it. Pretend you're on a date with that little sweet and get what you want. Because that helps you get in your body. Because a part of us disembodies when we eat the thing we say we don't want to eat. We check out. Oh my God, I'm being bad. I got to check out. I got to run away from myself. I got to get out of myself. And we're eating unconsciously. And when you eat unconsciously, you're going to eat more. And then you're going to feel even more guilty when you finally stop eating because you realize how much you ate. Getting present, getting aware is a cure, one of the cures along the way to transform emotional eating. Okay, so when you're going to eat the sugar, you got to be present. Sounds paradoxical, but it strengthens your choosing muscles. And it trains you how to be present, how to not check out. Because one of the reasons why we eat the thing that we say we don't want to eat is because we check out. Because the adult in us leaves. And the little kid in us takes over. The part of us that wants immediate gratification takes over. So when I'm asking you to slow down, receive pleasure, relax, enjoy, I'm actually asking the adult in you to step back in. That adult has stepped out. I'm asking you to invite that archetype, that voice, that persona. I'm asking you to invite that royal archetype, your king, your queen, your elevated prince or princess. Invite that voice back in. I'm telling you, it works. So third, if you crave something sweet, here's a great little biohack. Try drinking in that moment some vegetable broth or some bone broth or some miso broth right as the craving arises. So you can get these broths pre-made in a health food store. I suggest you drink them warm or hot as opposed to cold. Don't use the salt-free versions because the idea is you want to have some salt. You want to have electrolyte content. You're taking the electrolyte and mineral content from these broths, which have a way of helping cravings subside. For many people, this simple biohack works really well. So here comes the craving. Already have in your house in the cabinet, in the refrigerator. They come in those big aseptic containers. You can get vegetable broth, you can get bone broth, you can get miso broth. And you warm it up and you drink it. Notice what happens. Be present, taste it, be aware. If you want to take that a step forward, you could experiment with drinking such broths regularly during the day, at least several times during the day. Particularly if you know you tend to emotionally eat sugar at a certain time, then drink it 30 minutes before, 15 minutes before. You experiment, you see, you notice. Because what's happening is you're putting fast nutrition into your body, and the mineral balance, the electrolyte balance does something. It helps the system relax. A lot of times, and this is an odd thing, a lot of times we will crave the opposite of what we need. So you could actually be more deficient in a mineral. You could be more deficient in salt, in sodium, but you'll tend to crave the opposite. You'll crave a sweet. A lot of times people are deficient in fat and they'll crave sweet. For some reason, the brain will often crave that which it doesn't necessarily need when it's trying to correct an imbalance. I mean, if you think about it, an alcoholic craves alcohol. The alcoholic doesn't need alcohol. So brain can be funny in that way. So experiment with drinking broth right as your craving is coming on, or before it usually comes on, or a number of times throughout the day. Next, make sure you're not eating a low protein or low fat diet. So if you find yourself prone to intense sugar cravings, experiment with including more healthy protein, more healthy fat at your main meals and snacks. Because when you're low in either of these two macronutrients, I have noticed people will often crave sugar, just the opposite of what the body needs. Lastly, whatever happens and however much sugar you consume as you're learning to decrease your sweet intake, you got to forgive yourself once it happens. Once you do the bad deed, don't give your power away by continuing self-punishment. Stay in your dignity. Stay in your royalty. Move on with your day. Punishing yourself is only going to make the craving stronger the next time. You control the sentencing. You control the punishment. You're the jailer. You're the judge. You can commute your sentence. The more you beat yourself up emotionally, the more you're going to need to emotionally eat to get out of the pain that you yourself created. Okay, speaking of sugar, there's a fascinating health condition that can actually cause or contribute to sugar cravings when we have a specific form of gut dysbiosis, an overgrowth of the yeast or fungus Candida albicans. Sugar and carb cravings are almost predictable. That's because that little organism, Candida, relies on carbohydrates to thrive. So there's literally a proliferation of a tiny organism in your digestive tract that when it's overgrowing too much, it's screaming at you to consume carbs and sweets. And oddly enough, those little guys, when they all get together and scream, we hear it. Chemically, biologically, metabolically, we hear it. It literally can influence our cravings. So if you're experiencing some of the symptoms of candidiasis, if you're experiencing fatigue, sweet cravings, joint pain, brain fog, if you have recurring urinary tract infections, digestive issues, sinus infections, you can or may have a candida overgrowth, and it may be a source of your sweet cravings. So if you suspect this, my best recommendation is find a good functional medicine or natural doctor who works with this, and a stool test can often give you an accurate diagnosis, but you want to work with a professional, in my opinion. This issue is most often treated with diet and supplements. A lot of good practitioners will use diet supplements and an antifungal prescription medication. So there's ways to definitely transform a candida overgrowth and change your whole complexity of sugar cravings and help diminish or get rid of a lot of the symptoms I just mentioned. fatigue, sweet cravings, joint pain, brain fog, recurring urinary tract infections, sinus infections, etc. Okay, still more to the sugar story. Let's talk about blood sugar regulation and emotional eating. Human body needs to maintain blood sugar levels within a very tight range. The problem is, though, that many people experience fluctuations in blood sugar. When this happens, we can crave sugar and sweets, or any food for that matter. Meal skipping can cause blood sugar dysregulation. Chronic dieting can cause blood sugar dysregulation. Macronutrient balance can cause blood sugar dysregulation. A genetic predisposition to this condition can cause blood sugar dysregulation. So that's why it's important for those who are challenged with emotional eating to eat regular meals, to not calorie restrict, to not go on low protein or low fat diets. If you emotionally eat, you owe it to yourself to make sure you're not contributing to emotional eating with these ineffective strategies. You know, again, some people are more prone, genetically speaking, to blood sugar dysregulation. That's why your medical provider is often asking you, do you have a history of diabetes in your family? They're tracking things. A poor quality diet can also lead to blood sugar dysregulation. Specifically, poor quality diet can lead to deficiencies in zinc, in chromium, in iron, in magnesium, in vitamin B12, vitamin D, in essential fatty acids, in glutamine. And all of these that I just mentioned have been linked to low blood sugar and hence can lead to sweet cravings. Once again, I suggest working with a good natural or functional medicine physician to determine via testing any nutrient deficiencies that may be contributing just to health in general and to low blood sugar in specific, which can cause you actual sugar or carb cravings. Okay, let's still stay in the sugary universe for a moment, but in a different way. Let's look at artificial sweeteners and emotional eating. Now, you've been conditioned to believe that since real sugar is bad for us, then somehow an artificial sweetener must be good. Real sugar bad, artificial sweetener good. But let me tell you something, my friends, nothing could be further from the nutritional metabolic truth. Every artificial sweetener that's ever been invented has eventually, at some point, been proved to be neurotoxic and or cytotoxic. Toxic to your nerve cells, toxic to any cell. Bad for your health. What's more, after well over 60 years of artificial sweetener use, there is not a single valid study that has shown that these chemicals are useful for long-term weight loss. If these chemicals truly work for weight loss, they would have done so a long time ago. It's mind-boggling. The scientific irony, is that artificial sweeteners we have discovered will fool the brain into thinking that that artificial sweetener molecule is indeed a real sugar molecule. It kind of fires up your sweet taste, but oh, I think I'm eating something sweet. But it fools you to such a degree that the body will then generate an elevated insulin response. But then the insulin has nothing to do because there's no sugar, which over time, that elevated insulin response, if you're eating enough artificial sweeteners and drinking enough, it can lead to weight gain and weight loss resistance. So this is the dirty little secret about artificial sweeteners that the corporations don't want you to know. They don't want you to know that artificial sweeteners, A, haven't been shown to make people lose weight, and B, they fool your brain into thinking it's sugar, so you create an insulin response, and a consistent insulin response, raising insulin levels, can cause weight loss or inability, cause weight gain or inability to lose it. On top of that, the artificial sweetener molecule doesn't fool your taste buds enough. And ultimately, they're still calling for something sweet. So what happens is a lot of people who are stuck on artificial sweeteners are still craving sweet. So if you're struggling with sugar or you're simply a health conscious person, get artificial sweeteners out of your diet. Don't indulge the chemical industry in that way. It's not helping. They're not going to decrease your desire for sweet or help you lose weight. They're going to do the opposite. As you can tell, I don't like that stuff. Let's talk about chocolate and emotional eating. We got to talk about chocolate because it's a special case. It's far more than something sweet. In Ayurveda, chocolate is considered to contain all five tastes, which makes it a very desirable and naturally craveable food. So humans effortlessly love chocolate. It probably, I think it wins first prize in the Hall of Fame of craveable foods. Chocolate, though, is itself not a problem. But as we've seen, we can especially turn to chocolate as a food to emotionally eat when chocolate is the best thing you have going in your life. If you struggle with emotionally eating chocolate, here's the punchline. If you struggle with emotionally eating chocolate, then you have to figure out a way to make your life more like chocolate or better than chocolate. That's your task. Because if your life is not better than chocolate, then you're going to want chocolate. Because chocolate is just better than everything else. So why wouldn't you eat it? Because you want a good life. You want to be happy. You want to have fun. You want to feel good feelings. We came here to feel good. So if I'm not feeling good in my life, if I'm not feeling good in my relationship, if I'm not having love, if I don't have intimacy, if I don't have passions, if I don't have loves, I'm going to look for the closest approximation. I'm going to look for a symbolic substitute. And chocolate is as good as it gets. So you have to up-level your life. You have to create a life worth living. You got to create a life that's worth binging on. So you got to improve your love life or your relationship life or your work life or your social life, your inner life, all of it. And you got to stop fighting the chocolate itself. Fighting chocolate is not going to make you stop eating chocolate if chocolate's better than your life. It's a fight that you're not going to win because you want it. Because a part of you feels like you need it, and a part of you is kind of needing it because it's the best thing that happens. And as we've been mentioning, as it relates to sugar, same thing with chocolate. If you're going to eat it, then eat it. Get present, relax, enjoy, suck all the pleasure out of it. While you're eating, let go of any guilt, let go of any negative self-talk. Eat it slow. Spread out the pleasure experience. If you find yourself trying to resist it, but you eat it anyway, then build it into your diet. Know that you're going to have it every day at a certain time or two times a day, even. If you're eating it four times a day and it's haphazard, then literally schedule it in. Put it on your calendar. I am eating X amount of chocolate at this time during the day. Because you're claiming your power. You're saying, I'm going to eat it anyway, so I might as well choose when I'm going to eat it. And I might as well choose in advance how much. And you might not be able to fulfill that how much piece, but you're claiming power. You're stepping into the process. You're bringing in consciousness. You're letting your unconscious mind know that you don't have to fight your urge for it, that you're safe and you deserve to have pleasure. When you feel safe and when you feel you deserve, you know what state you're in? You're in the state of physiologic relaxation response. When you're safe, you're relaxed. When you're unsafe, you're stressed. So if I'm constantly thinking, oh my God, I'm not safe, I'm going to crave chocolate. And if I crave chocolate, that's bad because it's bad because I'm emotionally eating chocolate and it's going to make me fat and all these bad things. So then you're in a stress response. And what do? When you're in a stress response, you have to find a way to relieve it. And how do you relieve a stress response? You eat. And chocolate's a great stress reliever. So the more stress you create around eating chocolate, the more you'll need chocolate to relieve the stress response that you're creating around. Planning pleasure and satisfaction into your day helps you transcend a craving, not by fighting it, but by welcoming it, by working with it, by making friends with it. And then it becomes easier to manage and easier to regulate. Okay, let's talk about caffeine and emotional eating. Now, by the way, whatever I say about caffeine, I'm not saying caffeine is bad. We're talking about caffeine as it relates to emotional eating. Many people rely on a combination of caffeine and sugar in the morning as their breakfast or for their snacks during the day, meaning coffee and pastry or just coffee, coffee with sugar, without sugar, whatever. Again, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with sugar, but what can happen is when we're using caffeine as our exclusive energy source at any meal, your energy drink, your morning coffee, that's it. Meaning if you're using it as a meal replacement, essentially, it can give us what I'm going to refer to as a false metabolism. You're milking your system for energy. First of all, you're using glycogen stores, which you're using up very quickly. You're pulling nutrient stores, maybe a little bit out of your liver, but you're also going to pull nutrients, believe it or not, from the bone. And you're pulling it from wherever you can readily get it. And your body's going to go into a nutrient deficit. You don't have a true calorie-burning metabolism in that moment, meaning eat food, break it down, extract energy, burn calories. That's a calorie-burning metabolism. This can become quite a problem if you do this day in and day out. When we over-rely on caffeine for our energy and not food, the brain is going to register nutritional deficiency and ultimately scream hungry. And then you're going to be driven to eat. And all the while, you're going to think when you're driven to eat, once again, you're emotionally eating, but no, you're nutritionally deprived. If you're consistently doing caffeine-only breakfast or lunches or caffeine and carb-only meals and you're struggling with emotional eating, then experiment with letting go of that particular dietary habit. You got to eat real meals. You got to create a true calorie-burning metabolism. You got to look at how much caffeine you're doing. I had a client once who was eating a 12 to 1500 calorie diet. She was trying to lose 15 pounds. She was eating a 12 to 1500 calorie diet. She was running 4 or 5 miles a day. She was doing everything a human being ought to do to lose weight. That's traditionally taught. And she wasn't losing weight. When she came to see me after a dietary intake, wonderful conversation with this particular client, I noticed this. She was, we can call her a caffeine addict. She probably had about 7 instances during the day, breakfast, lunch, dinner, and several times during that where she would have coffee and or energy drink. And she was hooked on caffeine. Now, in that extreme case, what happens is caffeine can mimic the stress response in the body. It raises your heart rate, raises your blood pressure. It'll raise your level of cortisol and insulin, believe it or not. And caffeine's great when it's great. But in excess, what it was doing was it was driving her to gain weight because of what I consider it was a caffeine-driven stress response. So even though she's eating low calorie and she's exercising, she can't lose a pound. We weaned her off of caffeine. It took just a couple of weeks. She didn't want to go cold turkey, but she wanted to get rid of it right away. 6 months. All she did was change her caffeine consumption, some dietary tweaks, but she was actually eating more food. She was eating more healthy fat and more protein, ended up losing her 50 pounds. Remarkable. That started cluing me in to what excessive caffeine can do in the diet. So let's look at alcohol and emotional eating. For many people, excess use of alcohol can be problematic when it comes to emotional eating. And the main reason is that alcohol functions as a depressant. So you drank alcohol last night, you might very well find yourself needing an up the day after a night of drinking. So for many people, the thing that lifts us up most consistently in the morning is a combination of what? Carbohydrates and caffeine, which we have seen, if eaten as a consistent breakfast, can then lead to sweet and carb cravings throughout the day. So if you emotionally eat, I just want you to simply notice what you eat the morning after you've been drinking. So the morning after you've been drinking, do your best to have a breakfast centered on, again, healthy protein and fat. And consider moderating your alcohol use if you have more than 2 drinks a night. Just something to play with, just something to notice. Now, once again, I just want to remind you, I'm not saying alcohol is bad or caffeine is bad or donuts are bad or sugar is bad. We covered this concept of good foods and bad foods. We saw how when we label a food as good or bad and we eat that food, we end up attacking self. We end up punishing self. And that's not where I want you to go. So I want you to stop making your forbidden foods bad or evil. Food is neutral. If you're going to eat a food that's on your not-so-healthy-for-me-to-eat list, and I always want to encourage you to actually relax and enjoy it. And in order to do that, you have to take away the moral value from it. If you're relaxing with your food, even if it's a bad food, even if it's bad for your health, even if you know chocolate cake makes you feel yucky, but you're eating it anyway. And if you're eating that chocolate cake and you're stressed out and you go, oh, I shouldn't be eating this. I'm a bad person. This is a bad food. It's got sugar. It's got dairy. It's going to cause congestion. It's so bad for me. It's going to cause me to gain weight. Well, you're in a stress response. And when you're in a stress response, you're not in your fullest, healthiest digestion and assimilation and calorie burning capacity. So you might as well put yourself in a relaxation response, which is what? Enjoyment, pleasure, nourishment, slow. That puts you in a relaxation response, which means full, healthy digestion and assimilation and calorie burning. Can you see how that makes sense? Next, nutritional influence on emotional eating, oddly enough, can be dehydration. You know this. Oftentimes, human beings don't hydrate well enough. We don't drink enough water. Something fascinating happens for a lot of people when the brain senses dehydration in the body. So at its best, the brain is going to clearly signal to us that, oh, you're dehydrated, thirsty. We hear that thirst signal and we drink more water. However, a lot of us don't have an elevated, I'm one of these people, I don't have an elevated relationship with my thirst mechanism. So most people are much more attuned to their hunger than their thirst. So when we're thirsty, what often happens is you will go into a mild stress response when you're thirsty because your body doesn't like that. Your body wants to let you know, hey, you need water. Hey, this is not so good if this lasts a long time. So when you're thirsty, you go into a mild stress response, mild heart rate, mild blood pressure increase, blood sugar levels can drop. And then we become a little weak and irritable. And when blood sugar levels drop and are low and we feel a little weak and a little irritable, what's your tendency? Your tendency might be to eat. So we're confusing thirst and hunger. What we really are is thirsty, but we're thinking that we're hungry. And then we eat. And then we think we can't control our appetite. So bottom line, if you're facing emotional eating, hydrate well. And please focus on real water as opposed to juice or the sugar-filled sports drinks or milk or diet sodas or any soda for that matter. Train your body with water just as an experiment in moving towards the natural. Emotional eating and lack of movement and exercise. It's an interesting one. For many people, being too sedentary can lead to an increased appetite. If you're challenged with emotional eating, any movement is good. Even if you can only walk. Even if you can only do light yoga or stretching. Those are far better than no movement at all. Focus on the kind of movement and exercise that gives you some joy. You know, movement and exercise are some of the most powerful natural appetite regulators. Movement can also help regulate our emotions, meaning exercise helps us transmute and resolve feelings of stress, boredom, depression, anxiety, anger, any emotion that's unwanted. It helps move that energy in a physical and kinesthetic way, but in an actual biochemical way. Now, it's worth mentioning that for many people, the word exercise has a negative connotation, and it can symbolize something you have to do as a punishment for eating or a punishment for having body fat, or exercise was something that you did when you were in junior high school or high school and they made you do dumb exercise that you didn't like. And a lot of people have exercise trauma from when they were young. So doing exercise that you resent continues the cycle of emotional eating. It can make us feel resentful, which can then have us wanting to medicate those bad feelings by eating. So if this describes you, change things up. Choose the kind of movement you enjoy. Choose movement that makes you feel good about being in your body, that comes easier for you, that inspires you to do, even if you don't think it burns calories or even it doesn't burn as many calories. Hike, dance, yoga, Pilates, walk, swim, bike, whatever. Whatever's calling to you. Lastly, let's talk about lack of sleep and emotional eating. Lack of sleep has been very well researched to deregulate appetite. Specifically, not enough sleep can trigger increased levels of the hormone ghrelin, decreased levels of the hormone leptin, which overall leads to increased hunger. More specifically, the hormone ghrelin stimulates an increase in appetite and it slows metabolism. thereby decreasing the body's ability to burn fat. Leptin provides a sense of satiation, and it helps the body maintain normal weight on a longer-term basis. So on a more relatable level, lack of sleep makes you tired, makes you irritable and cranky the next day, makes you more susceptible to unwanted emotions, makes you not fun to be around for other people and for yourself, which in turn can drive us to emotionally eat because I'm not feeling so good about myself. Had a bad night of sleep. Sleepless humans are not so joyful. Well-rested humans, happier. So if you have trouble with sleep and you struggle with emotional eating, it can be extremely helpful to make some headway here. And this isn't easy necessarily, and it's obviously a more in-depth topic. I suggest you refer to the books written by Dr. Michael Breus. That last name is spelled B-R-E-U-S. Dr. Breus is one of the world's foremost experts on sleep. Love his material, his books, his programs, highly recommended. So, my friends, we've covered quite a bit of key nutritional lifestyle and metabolic influences on emotional eating. And I've been providing for you suggested practices along the way. So refer to the notes for this week's session to help remind you of what we've covered and see what changes are calling out to you. Then take some action, make those changes, and look at it all as part of your emotional eating journey, part of you being a nutritional explorer. You experiment like an excited and curious scientist, about your own body, and you see what works. I might have mentioned a lot of different things that you think to yourself, oh my God, so many of those might be something important to me. So go easy on yourself. Just start with two tweaks, two changes, two experiments in terms of diet and emotional eating. You could even start with one. That's okay. But go easy on yourself. Do what's doable for you and see what's calling to you. Use your intuition. A lot of times I find that people's nutritional intuition is far more strong, far more powerful, far more accurate than they give it credit for. Your intuition is not going to be 100% all the time, but if something on this in this conversation jumped out for you about a change or a tweak that you want to make, if it caught your attention, then pay attention to that. I think that's a good thing. So I'm glad for you that you have so many great places to work when it comes to transforming emotional eating. I suspect that by now in this program, you're making some good headway. You're making some progress. You're seeing some daylight. And there's still more to come, my friends. There's lots more to come. There's some great material to come. This concludes session number 7 of the Emotional Eating Breakthrough Program. I shall see you in the next session. Thank you.